budget design is potentially a really scary thing. It's also a really, really important thing. The context in which we're going to be talking about it this afternoon is primarily going to be through the lens of designing a budget that you will be sending to an external funder for some form of proposal. However, what we are going to be discussing is equally applicable for non-funded research. So say you are in a fortunate position, a fortunate enough position to be asked by your dean to stand up a digital humanities center. As part of that process, you're going to have to think about creating a budget. You're going to have to start, you would be thinking about a budget in terms of what are your initial needs and what are your long-term needs. And you might be creating something on an annual basis to distribute the costs of keeping it going over a period of time. And what you don't want to find yourself doing is what our U.S. Congress is doing right now and arguing over whether or not you have enough money to do what you want to do. So, getting started. The first and most important thing is to plan ahead. Jot down notes. In particular, refer very closely to your work plan. This is where the work that you have done, that you've done in developing this piece, the work plan piece, really pays off. This is where all of that time that you spend calculating the equivalent amount of time that someone might be working on the project gets translated into real cents and dollars. So having spent the time working out that it's going to require a 20% time programmer to do this, that means you know more or less exactly what dollar allocation you're going to have to use. You need to know, obviously, very obviously, what is the most amount of money that is available to you. It's all very well coming up with this wonderful plan that is going to create a digital archive of the entirety of human knowledge, but if your budget is only $50,000, you're not going to get very far in that process. This obviously feeds back into your work plan. It feeds back into your project development. All of these items are really interconnected, and they really inform each other. Always double check a specific solicitation for specific dollar requirements or limitations. Oftentimes, you will find a proposal that does not allow you to include salary expenses as part of the solicitation. That's especially true of some of the larger NSF awards. One in particular that leaps to mind is an MRI proposal, which is up to $1 million to essentially purchase a single piece of equipment. So in that instance, there's absolutely no point including in your budget time for money for people, money for a project manager. It all would be going to the purchase of that specific piece of equipment. Use a template if possible. That's probably the best piece of advice I'm going to give you for this. If you don't have access to a budget template, we actually have provided you with one in the additional materials that you can download. What I mean by that is an Excel spreadsheet that does all of the calculations for you. So all you have to worry about is putting in the actual dollar figures, and it's going to calculate how that translates into benefit costs. It's going to automatically calculate for you the indirect rates, which is something that we will be talking about a lot during this session. The advantage of doing this is, A, you don't need to use a calculator, and B, B, it eliminates a lot of potential for errors. And C, it allows you to play with your figures. It allows you to make changes on the fly. It allows you to see really quickly and easily what the impact of adding in of adding one full-time employee to your budget is going to do. Right? So it allows you to play with different scenarios. It allows you to play with different time frames. You can see what the difference in your budget on a multi-year one is with doing one part of the project in year one versus year two. That sort of thing. Here's that word again, indirects. Don't forget to include them. I'm just going to breeze over that for right now. And finally, don't be afraid to ask for help. And that help will likely come from your university's grants office, but it could also come from someone else who you know has had experience putting these things together, whether on campus or off campus. Yeah?
Does one have to go through the grants office to submit all grants, for example, on NEH? Do you have to go through your grants office?
Yes. Yeah, we'll be talking very specifically about the grants process in the first session. This afternoon, I think it is. I forget. But we do have a slide deck specifically on the grant process. But yes, 99.9% of the time, your university is going to require you to submit your budget for review by the grants office. And that's wonderful because it helps with, well, it helps with that line. Don't be afraid to ask for help because you have a contact. Basically what it is second pair of eyes, and they're going to be able to tell you if you've made some horrific mistake on it. They are generally actually going to be looking to make sure that you're not going to be doing anything illegal, because ultimately what happens when you submit a grant is that your vice chancellor or vice president for research affixes his signature to the grant transmittal form. So it's his neck on the line if you're actually proposing to do something illegal. So yeah, they absolutely want to see it, and they will absolutely double check it very carefully for you, or at least they should do if they're doing their jobs properly. Sometimes, though, you know, we're all human. Sometimes things will slip through the cracks. And I've definitely had occasions where my interpretation of a solicitation is different to the grants officers, and we've engaged in a dialogue as to whether or not we think something is an allowable expense or whether or not something is in the right category. Okay, so what are the different elements that make up a budget? The first and typically the largest element is going to be salaries. And there are a whole variety of different types of salaries, which we'll be breaking down in a minute. But there are a couple of things that you want to think about when you're before you even get started. The first is base the calculations on your actual salary. There is absolutely no point and saying that you're going to be working 20% on this project if you claim that you're making $30,000 less than you are, because you will end up actually only being able to work if your boss is up to speed and knows this, you'll actually only be working 15% of your time on it, or something along those lines. So you want to be accurate. You also, and this is very much a bone of contention with some people I've worked with, you cannot give yourself a pay increase through a grant. It seems pretty obvious, but it's also something that people routinely ask me. Hey, if I write in that I make that my salary is $15,000 more and we fund it at 100%, surely that's okay because it's not coming off of the university's books. Well, no. Grant money is what is called soft money, which means it's not permanent. So that might be great for year one of your project while you're funded, but in year two, when you're suddenly going off of the university's funds, they're going to ask, why did you have an extra $15,000 on your salary?
What do you do if, like, I'm on a nine-month salary?
Yeah, so we'll be talking specifically about faculty in a minute.
Okay.
What you can do is you can include an annual 3% cost of living increase. Whether or not you will actually get that is another matter. I have included an annual 3% cost of living on every grant that I have been a part of since 2005. I can count on two fingers the number of times I have actually received a 3% annual cost of living. Yeah, it might only be one, because 1 year I got 2% increase. So NSF NEH actually want to see that, because they are anticipating that you are going to receive it, and that has to be covered. What it doesn't include is, say, I'm doing such a fantastic, wonderful job, and I get a 15% pay increase because my boss loves me and they can't survive without me. You can't actually then go back into the grant and say, he received a 15% increase, so we need to bump that 15%. What you would need to do in that situation is either lower the amount of time committed to a person through the grant, or do a rebudget where you take that money from somewhere else to apply to the additional funds that would come into the salary. Yeah.
How do funders feel about rebudgeting, though? Isn't that kind of frowned upon?
Rebudgeting is generally frowned upon. What you will find, and what I have found, is it's okay to move things within categories. So if you budget a total of $20,000 that's going to go towards salaries, and you say that it's going to be distributed evenly between four people, if you then decide, well, actually, it's going to be more efficient for us to take that $20,000 and distribute it between five people, they're okay with that. What they're not okay with, generally speaking, is where you say that you're going to spend $20,000 on $20,000 on salaries, and you budgeted, say, $1,000 on equipment purchases. And then you suddenly decide that, actually, what I really need for this is a state-of-the-art video camera that costs $5,000, and I want to take that $5,000 from my salary category and apply it to the equipment. They're going to ask a lot of questions of that. They might very well approve it, but they're going to want to know why it is that you suddenly decided that you needed this piece of equipment that is $4,000 more than you had originally budgeted. What is the reason for it? What are the benefits? What is going to be the overall impact of that purchase on your ability to carry out the work, given that you are now $4,000 in the hole in terms of your salary? So your program officers are going to be, they're going to listen to you, and if you can explain it, they will oftentimes be willing to let you do that. But they're going to look for there are certain things that are going to raise alarm bells. Large equipment purchases that weren't originally budgeted for is one of those alarm bells, especially if you are 2 months away from the grant ending and you're suddenly asking for a computer or a video camera or something that can very obviously be used for purposes that do not belong to the grant.
What happens in the sort of a DH context where, say, you do need to buy computers? What happens to those computers at the end of the grant?
It depends.
Well, what should happen?
What should happen is that they go into a nice cabinet like that, and they sit there. If a piece of equipment is absolutely critical for a project, then it's obviously absolutely fine to write it in. The expectation is that it will only be used for that project, and at the end of the life, it will not be used for something else. If you're buying a laptop, to be for a faculty member to use on a digitization project, that's fine. It's something that you can probably continue using beyond it. They're more likely to have issues with you saying that you're going to be buying a laptop for use by undergraduate students or for graduate or even graduate students. Again, it's all about the budget justification and it's how you frame it. The key is to make sure that when you're describing purchases like computers and especially cell phones and tablets and things like that, that you very clearly delineate how it will be used by the project, and you talk about how it will also benefit future research moving forward.
So if I'm doing a project that specifically requires people to have iPads, then obviously I need to make sure for my sample that everybody has the same iPad, blah, blah, blah.
Right, absolutely. So, an example would be that the augmented reality grant that I was talking about yesterday. That obviously relied on mobile devices. And we actually got into this huge discussion with our grants office when we were putting together the budget for that, because the purchase of cell phones is not allowed at the University of Illinois for any reason anymore. It became a huge, huge issue because people were misusing the privilege and a variety of other things. So we actually had to demonstrate to them and get a formal waiver from the Vice Chancellor of Research there that allowed us to purchase cell phones. And we had to say, okay, these are the people who are going to have access to the cell phones. These are the people who are... this is what is going to happen to them when they are not being used. And we had to promise that we were not going to actually activate them with on a pay contract. So cell phones, tablets, mobile devices in general are the things that especially raise alarm bells because they're very easy to walk away with and for them to disappear. So going back to salaries, you need to make sure that everyone is in the right salary class. The reason for that is that generally speaking, different people in different salaries, in different types of position, have different benefits associated with them. So a faculty member has a very different benefits package to what in Illinois is called an academic professional. At Clemson, we have a differentiation between two types of permanent staff who are 100%, that they're on 12-month contracts. One type is considered to be permanent, and another type is considered to be temporary, even though they actually seem to be just as permanent as and as much of a fixture as the so-called permanent one. Yeah?
I sometimes get a little pushback. We don't have an option. But I sometimes get a little pushback, and I have problems with it because I think it's. I'd rather just hire somebody part time and give them benefits. I get a lot of pushback. Oh, hire this person as a contract.
Mm-hmm.
How do you handle that?
Generally speaking, the universities don't like to hire people unnecessarily. It's all about the justification. The argument that you need to be able to make is that you're hiring, certainly if you're talking about a professional person, what you need to be able to do is demonstrate that they are not just going to be able to work on this project. Now, if you, or that it's going to be more cost effective for you to do it as a permanent position. And what that means is that essentially in that situation, you would be looking to show that you're covering 100% of their time at the salary that you are doing. At that point, my experience is that the universities are fine with it. They just want to know where the money's going, and you structure the contract so that and the job announcement so that people applying for it are aware that. Or whether it is potentially a 1-year gig or a 2-year gig or whatever the length of your project is. So oftentimes you will see you will see a line on a job announcement, something along the lines of the position is renewable based on performance or availability of funding. So that is that's kind of the giveaway that this is going to be that your position is going to be funded off of soft money, grant money, rather than off of university hard money.
Yeah,
that's a more permanent source. So, the first type of salary that you're going to encounter is going to be faculty salaries. And faculty are an unusual case in a lot of this. They are typically, not always, but typically are going to be on 9-month contracts. Those of you who are on a 9-month faculty contract will know that you actually don't get vacation time, in theory, right? You don't get paid vacation. You instead have a lot of flexibility and you get 3 months off in the summer where you can do your own personal research or you can disappear on a hiking trip around the Himalayas if you want. What this means for grant writing and for budget development is that your faculty salary is typically going to be applied in the form of summer salary. And summer salary is different from regular salary because, and this is one of the many reasons I want to become a 9-month tenured faculty member. When you are on a 9-month contract, you can choose one of two things. You can either have your salary deposited to you in 9 monthly payments or 12 monthly payments. Most people choose the 12 monthly payment because they obviously have to live for those 3 months. However, when you're calculating what the actual rate for 9 months for the summer salary on the 9-month contract is, you take their salary and you divide it by 9, not by 12, which means that they receive more in summer salary on a monthly basis than they do regularly if they have done the 12-month option. What that actually means practically is don't ask your faculty member what they make each month. Ask them what they make each year. Because that is going to be... That's true for all of this. You need to be asking what the base salary rate is rather than what the monthly take-home pay is, because that's what the calculations are based off of. There are a couple of limitations to all of this. The National Science Foundation in particular does not like faculty to work more than 2 months during the summer. They actually have a requirement which is called a current and pending file, where you list all of the grants and all of the work that that a participant on the project is currently engaged with, so that they can see at a glance, oh, this faculty member is actually claiming that they're going to be doing 4 months of work over the summer, and they do not like that. They will veto it. Your grants office, if it is good, will also tell you that you're completely overloaded and you can't do that. Sometimes they will, sometimes they won't. So as a general rule, even with places that don't require you to limit it to 3 months, we will never write a faculty salary as larger than 2 months of summer salary. Ever. That's my rule. That's Jen's rule. And oftentimes it's going to be a lot less than that, just depending on how involved they are, because a lot of faculty will be engaged on 3 or 4 projects, so you kind of have to get a sense of that from them as to what they're already committed to. However, there is an alternative to summer salary. You can also do course buyouts. The calculation for how that is calculated is going to vary from university to university, so you basically need to ask the faculty member involved what their departmental policy is as to how much it is. What that basically means is that instead of teaching a course one semester, they will be working on your grant. In terms of your budget, all you need to do is plug in what figure they tell you, and in your budget justification, which is where you explain what it is, you just need to make clear that the faculty member will be doing this through a course buyout rather than a summer salary. And there's the NSF thing. Yeah.
Faculty can also give their contributions in kind, right?
Yes. We'll talk about in kind.
Okay.
things in a couple of minutes. I mean, yes, you can actually, any of this can in theory be contributed in kind. So you could, for example, if you are part of a center and you part of the project is that you are developing a web presence, and on your regular staff you have a web programmer, you could in theory you can say that that the web design is relatively minimal and it's going to be done as part of this person's regular job, so we're not asking for it. Typically speaking, universities frown upon in-kind donations or in-kind work. And the reason for that is that wonderful phrase, indirect costs, which we'll talk about.
Well, in our case, we have the two faculty members who have to be at control, but they're not actually working on the project all that much. So it's just like advisement.
Yeah, what we do, because this faculty salaries tends to be, if you look at it purely in terms of what everyone makes each year, faculty salaries, especially if you have a collaborator who is in electrical engineering or computer science, their salary line is going to be the largest. Likewise, if you have an endowed professor who's on it, their salary line is going to be quite large. And what you will find is even if you say, oh, they're only going to be working 0.1 months on the project, that can sometimes be $10,000 or more by the time you add on benefits and all the rest of that good stuff. So yes, especially on smaller scale grants, things like the Digital Humanities Startup Grants, we will essentially do, we'll do crazy figures like 0.05 is the number of months that someone is working on the project, or even we'll do it as zero time and just say that they're donating their time to the project. So it's just, these are kind of creative ways of fitting your budget within the budget limitations. Okay, so the next category is staff salaries. Staff salaries, these are non-faculty collaborators. These are going to include folks like your project manager, your programmers, your system administrator, things like that. They are almost always, and by almost always, I mean I have never come across a situation where this isn't the case. They're almost always going to be 12-month. And that is the main reason why you differentiate between 9 months and 12 months. This is an important line. You can't include in your budget the time that you spent developing the budget or the proposal or the project. The assumption is that the work that you're doing on the proposal is going to be all future work from the moment you hit submit. So you can't kind of do you can't have a situation where you include a grant writer in your project, for example. This can sometimes cause problems. I actually had a meeting in the first week of December specifically on this topic. This is actually why this line was on, because it was actually the day after, it was the day before I did these slides, where our grants office were querying why I was included in the budget, because I was their point person for submitting the budget. And my response was, well, the work that I'll be doing on it is on this particular project is project manager. It's very distinct, it's clearly justified and delineated from the work that I do in preparing the project for submission. But that's something that will always raise a red flag if you include something like a grant writer on the project, because they don't want to be paying for work that you have already done, essentially. And then, don't underestimate salary. Yeah. No, it's okay, because it will just,
There are more sentences we have.
There are plenty more sentences.
So I guess my question, so I understand exactly why you can't include the grant writer.
Mm-hmm.
But say the grant is due
May 31st to start September 1st.
Mm-hmm.
Can you count the work between June 1st and September 1st? So it's after the grant has been
when
submitted.
When you receive the grant, there is a start date and an end date.
Okay.
And all expenses has to be applied during that period.
What about
conferences
that happen outside of that? Like,
Our
major conference happens in March, but NEH grants aren't. You don't technically get the money until May.
Right, so you wouldn't be able to do it.
Nope. It has to actually physically occur and happen during the period.
Yeah.
You could do
next year's, but not this year's in that situation. It absolutely... Any expenses that hit your account have to fall within the period. The next type of salary that you're going to come across are students, and you have a decision to make. Do you want students who are research assistants or hourly students? The decision on that is going to depend very much on the type of work that you're going to be asking them to do. Research assistants are especially good for projects that require them to engage for an extended period of time on the project. Now, you want to know that they are going to be working or dedicating 20 hours a week on your project, and they're going to be doing that either over the course of a full semester or over the course of a full academic year or over the course of a summer. That's a really good time to do it. Oftentimes, it will be a student programmer is a very common type of research assistant that you would have in that. Other times, you might have someone like Jen, depending on your shop. You might have you might have a student who is acting in the role of project manager or as a less so a systems administrator, but they might be the lead programmer, something along those lines. The disadvantage of having a research student, is that you have to pay their tuition, typically. Tuition takes the form of either a percentage of their overall salary or as a flat rate, just depending on what the particular policies of your institution are. So, at Illinois, it was calculated as a percentage of what you were paying them, which was great because history students are cheap, computer scientists are expensive. Guess what type of graduate student we chose most often? Historians. Because that meant that our tuition, the cost of tuition in our budgets was significantly lower. Difference is $15,000 or $20,000 for a 9-month salary. At Clemson, on the other hand, you pay a flat rate. So if you have a graduate research assistant for an academic year, it doesn't matter if you're paying them $15,000 or $20,000, you're still going to pay $10,000 in tuition remission. So it's one of those things that... you need to remember, but the answer to how that is calculated is going to depend very much on where you are and what the policies are at your university. Yeah.
In privates, one of the things that we find is a lot of privates give a lot of campus-based aid, and so when they get awards, when students get awards, it's applied immediately to the financial aid instead of giving to the student.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm.
So that can be an issue as well.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
I'm confused about this percentage of salary thing. Like, if it's a graduate student, why would one be $15,000 and one be $20,000?
So...
Because departments set their own rates for how much they're paid.
Yes.
And this is a big thing. It's certainly a big thing in Illinois. For context, the University of Illinois graduates... employee organization, basically the students at Illinois are unionized,
mm-hmm.
the graduate students, and they very almost went on strike because there were concerns over granting of tuition waivers. But the university, in justifying all of this, would point to, well, the average graduate student is making $20,000 plus all of the tuition things on top of it. Well, that's great because, you know, all of the computer scientists and the engineers are making $25,000. The people in history and arts, even if they're on a 50% contract, might be making only $12,000. And a lot of people in School of Arts in particular are actually on 33% or 25% appointments.
Mm-hmm.
So
to be a little more practical in terms of thinking about this, generally speaking, science graduate students, so computer science, physics, mathematics, the ones that are in the sort of hard geology sciences as well, are on 12-month appointments, and their full year rides the entire time they're at their institution, because their money usually is coming from a grant that their faculty member that they work with has gotten to run their lab or to do projects. In the humanities, on the other hand, usually that money is pooled into a department, and the department has to support all of the graduate students regardless of the status of their faculty member. You hope your faculty member is a good faculty member who gets research assistance and support from grants that they write, like these kinds of things. But by and large, humanities students are on 9-month appointments. So I have to take not my 9 months of salary and make it last 12 months to be a full-time scholar. In the sciences, they don't have to do that. And because their rates can be topped up easily because there's additional cash flow into science departments through labs and through commercial patents and things like that, they have a much easier time than humanistic graduate students in terms of generating salary and things like that. So a big grant in the humanities is $25,000. Mm-hmm. A big grant in the sciences is $20 million. Most science faculty and CS usually are generating $250,000 just by sneezing.
Yeah.
It's a difference.
At our university, like I had my tuition waiver, mm-hmm. and then I was on a 50% with my teaching, and then I got another 25% at the media, the digital media center. So are you saying that in the sciences, they could, through the university, just be making all kinds of salary,
yep.
all kinds of bank, and it's unregulated?
The girl who lived next to me in graduate school was in paper sciences, which
mm-hmm.
is like the people who figure out how to like make paper better, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And she made $42,000 a year as a graduate student year-round because it's a highly competitive program. She was recruited 84 different ways, and she like negotiated what she got offered. Mm-hmm. I started in graduate school making $8,000 a year. And you weren't allowed to work more. And universities set a cap on how much your graduate students can work. So here at Maryland, it is very difficult to get them to approve anything more than a 50% 20-hour week position.
Mm-hmm.
On the other hand, I, as a graduate student at IChaz, worked 67% pretty much from the day I stopped being an hourly employee.
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, forced them to give me a regular job so that I could make even more money because I was doing the work of a regular faculty member as a graduate student.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Our university, it works that almost all graduate students have graduate assistantships, and they're different levels, as you can see. So for our budget, we did a percentage of a grad A assistantship.
Yeah, if A is your lowest level, you don't want to use that.
That's the highest
level.
You
want to use whatever your highest level is.
The three of us
are
all actually grad
yeah.
A's for our
So
work.
Generally how universities divide out graduate students is graduate students that are still in coursework are level ones. They're the ones that the university has set a minimum of like $12,000 or $14,000. They get the rock bottom. If they've made it past coursework to their comps, that's when they usually, or they've been there a certain number of years, they get promoted to level two. And then usually they get like 2% or 5% on top. And then there are level three people who have defended their proposal or in a dissertation work. Those are level three people. They usually make 10% more than everybody else does. But it just depends on your university. These are the types of questions you want to ask your grant administrator.
We did. We sat down with her like 17 times, and she just did not know. we had a really hard time getting answers to how we should pay the graduate students. It seemed like the faculty was easy. She's like, here's their salary, here's their amount.
From a structural perspective, here's the deal. And this is where Simon and I always fight with our bosses. Anything less than what is the equivalent of a full-time position for a graduate student is a pain in the ass. Because that graduate student has divided focus. Because we have to share them with other people who may have demands on their time. We figure out ways to get graduate students to full-time positions because you're likely to get a higher quality candidate.
Right.
If you can give them 20 hours a week for 9 months or 20 hours a week for 12 months, then you are, if you only have 5 hours every week or every third week with them and they're busy teaching and doing everything else.
And that's why this bullet point is there. You want, if you're having a research assistant, you want to make it worth their while to be part of the project, and you want to maximize your access to them, which means 20 hours a week working on it.
And this is where you go back to your work plan, and you make sure that when you've got your student, you have tasks waiting for them when they finish the one that they've just done. There's already another one waiting. Because every time you don't use them, you're losing money.
Anything else? Okay. Very briefly. Yeah.
A question that sort of peripherally applies to this. If you have, if your institution has another source that can supply research of students, you know, for any given task.
What do you mean by another source?
For example, Union College itself has a pot of money.
Uh-huh.
That they will allot for students to work on a faculty project.
Yeah.
Can you also write that into the grant, that that's part of what you already will have lined up?
What that is called is an in-kind commitment, and Simon will talk about
in-kind. That's the
in-kind commitment.
Yeah, that would be an example.
Basically,
anything, any service that your university or institution might provide on top of the budget is going to be an in-kind donation. And my rule of thumb... is unless the donor specifically wants to see in-kind donations from the institution, you don't talk about them. And the reason for that is that the university sees that they're providing in-kind donations and they want to know why the hell they're doing that.
Funders can also reduce your award if they see that you have lots and lots of in-kind donations that aren't necessarily allocated appropriately. And so they'll reduce your award and say, well, you've got all this help, and in our estimation, what we're going to give you plus the help you already have is plenty.
Yeah.
So you want to be judicious about using in-kind language appropriately.
Right.
We use in-kind here on faculty who are super expensive to match out things. So university, because we have to do a buyout for faculty for certain situations, if we do a buyout on somebody, we use that as an in-kind. Because that person costs $40,000 and the grant will only pay them $20,000, yet we know they're going to work on their project for 50% of their life. That's $20,000 of in kind, and we're pretty explicit about it.
Yeah. Okay, so talking briefly about hourly students. Hourly students are great for projects that have small budgets, overall budgets, because you don't have to worry about any of this. It means that you can very clearly say how much time they're going to be working on the project. They're really good if you need, for example, an undergraduate student to man a help desk at a Digital Humanities Winter Institute.
That's what ours are. And ours are actually supported by the university, by the way.
So for very specific tasks or for short-term tasks, hourly students are absolutely the way to go. And that can include things like you'll have an hourly student who might be responsible for uploading content to your website. That sort of thing, if you don't have a dedicated web programmer on staff, something along those lines. The disadvantage of hourly students is that, generally speaking, they aren't as committed. Generally speaking, they have very, very divided attentions, because what you're paying them really isn't going to be very much. The way that I calculate it is generally it's going to be $10 an hour for no more than 20 hours a week. So it's a very low wage option, but it can be very useful for particular types of projects, or if you are engaging in a very you're engaging in a more complex project that has some tight budget limitations on it, and research assistants aren't an option because of the tuition remission issue. The other advantage of hourly students is you also aren't paying for benefits, you aren't paying for healthcare, that sort of thing. So the associated fringes that go on top of that are much less. So they're generally they're just in general a much cheaper option, and they're great for things like the $25,000 startup grant, right? Because you're not going to get very far with a graduate if you. We'll talk about the construction of a grant right at the end, but a research assistant who is making $15,000 plus tuition of best case scenario probably $7,500. That's $22,500 of your $25,000 proposal, and that doesn't include indirects. It doesn't include anything else that you might want to include on it. Okay, so beyond salaries, what are other things that you will include in your budget that you need to think about? The first is you'll, especially on NSF grants, but also NEH grants, you will see a category called equipment, and you'll think, sweet, this is where I'm going to put my laptop. No. The equipment category is actually only for large-scale purchases. Typically purchases that cost more than $5,000 for a single item. So that doesn't mean that you can buy $2,000 pieces of equipment and throw it in here. The reason for that is that the equipment category doesn't generate indirect costs for the university. Yeah. We'll get there. I promise we'll get there. Indirects are the last thing that the last thing I'll be talking about, just because it's the thing where, yeah, anyway.
It's the thing where you lose your mind.
It's the thing where you lose your mind, and it's the thing where you want to stand up and scream and kill someone because you've carefully constructed this budget and you realize that, wait a minute, this is going to blow everything up and I have to rethink and start over. Equipment that goes in this category can only be used for the purposes described in your proposal. So you cannot say that you are buying a server for this project and then use it to host all of your other project websites at the same time.
Melissa, you look puzzled.
So what do you do with that equipment after your project's done?
It goes in the shelf behind you.
Legally, it technically is something that is supposed to be mothballed and or given to whoever it is that processes equipment out of your university. But they would have to come find you and check and make sure you've done that.
Yeah.
And I have yet to have that happen in 7 years that they've asked.
Can you sort of, like, say you have a bunch of projects going on and you say, I need a server. Can you allocate a portion of a server to
Yes.
You?
Yes, but that would not fall
no.
into the equipment
okay.
category. The way to trump it is that you frame the description of the equipment and you frame your grant as this is going to support further research beyond the time of the project. Because that is then saying that you are creating a sustainable infrastructure and it's a long-term investment. So that's how you get around it in this case. Yeah.
Can you just give an example of the kind of because I'm just wondering what kind of equipment.
What kind of equipment? So, the equipment category, honestly, for digital humanities projects is very, very rarely used because of this $5,000 limit.
Unless you are doing something like building a lab, like what you saw from Brian
right.
Norberg last night at Ignite, where you're talking large-scale printers that can run you $6,000, $7,000, $8,000, $9,000, $10,000.
Mm-hmm.
Video
yeah.
walls, immersive video
yeah,
walls,
video walls.
Immersive technology can run that amount of money.
As I said, you know the red camera is like $10,000.
Depending on if you get commercial level video cameras, things like that, they can run about $5,000.
Yeah.
So nothing in meth is above $5,000, by the way.
Yeah.
It all like coming out of there.
Yeah. For your first project, it's very unlikely that you will be aware of this. The reason we're talking about it is because of that limitation there.
I'm just wondering why the $5,000?
It's actually set by in this case, because this is the statistic that NEH uses, it's actually set by the Federal Budget Office as part of their policy setting for Congress. So all of the facts and figures and rules you see in this are actually legislated according to congressional rules and the federal, what is the name of that acronym, the budget, FBO or whatever,
yeah.
The Federal Budget Office. The people who produce the report, this is how the U.S. economy is going, also set these standards for how the federal government and states act behave because this is federal money.
And do they assume that if it's under 5,000, it should come from this?
No, if it's under 5,000, it's called trivial, and you put it in a different category. There's a category.
So
they
consider
$5,000 the threshold for somebody who needs to pay attention.
Part of the reason why they've chosen 5,000 is because of this line here. Okay, you have to include for these purchases vendor quotes. And what that means is that you have to show that you have done some form of due diligence, and you have to be able to show that you aren't just going out there and buying the most expensive piece of equipment because your aunt Jane happens to work for that company.
In digital humanities, where the vendor quotes things come into play is usually digitization services, so contracting out for somebody to do all the digitization you need, or contracting out, we're using a vendor quote right now on a very special person who knows so much about TEI and XML, and it would take us years to create the kind of thing he can do in a week for us in terms of data curation workflows. So we have a vendor quote with him. He has a vendor relationship with us. We pay him. He's a line item separate from staff and salaries.
Yeah.
Do these people have to come out of your university's approved vendor list? Or
you
not
can get them approved.
You have, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah,
but it can take a little bit of work.
Okay.
So you want to identify if this is actually worth your time. For digitization, it is always worth your time to have those people approved, even if you haven't put out a grant yet, because at any given time, you may have to contract out.
Yeah.
Most universities, large universities, though, have their own digitization vendors already set up that are already pre-approved.
I just wanted to make sure that I understood what Jim was saying earlier, because we, in our project, we think we're going to need about $8,000 to $10,000 worth of equipment, but it's going to be like 3 dozen things. So would you put it on your proposal?
No,
under
it's
trivial?
A single purchase. It goes mm-hmm. under trivial because it is a single purchase of more than $5,000.
Well, right, but what? So, but
the equipment is a single piece of equipment that costs more than $5,000.
Mm-hmm.
So you cut. So if you're populating a lab of IMAX,
mm-hmm.
you know, those run $1,500 each. You buy 20 of those, that's clearly well over $5,000.
Right.
But because each individual piece are identical or close to identical
mm-hmm.
And cost less than the $5,000, they would go into a different budget category.
But you can still ask for them.
You can still ask for them, yes, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
Thank you.
Yeah, you just, you know, again, you write your budget justification to explain what their use is. They just wouldn't fall in this equipment category. And it's very confusing because equipment, well, of course a lab of IMAX is going to fall under that. No, they don't. Any other questions about this? Yeah.
I might be jumping ahead with this, but so take this room,
uh-huh.
for instance. So you have the infrastructure here that allows us to bring our stuff and to use it productively. What category would that go under?
It's called a capital expenditure or a capital purchase. You have to read the guidelines to see whether grants will cover capital purchases
yeah.
or equipment or renovations.
We will talk about this in the context of indirect costs.
Yes.
Okay.
So NEH grants, except for the challenge grant, will not pay for capital expenditures. You can't renovate a room with an NEH grant unless it's a challenge grant. You can't put in new wiring or do any of that stuff.
You couldn't buy that projector
yeah.
with it. If it's a general purpose lab, you could buy it if it is very specific to the project, but just a general use projector, you could not do. Okay, anything else on equipment? Okay, the next category is a catch-all. It's other direct costs. Now, a direct cost is a cost that is directly applied to the project. And it covers a vast range of different types of expense. For example, travel. In theory, you could actually write a grant and you could include the cost of coming to attend DHWI. Into a budget. you'd have to explain why your attendance at DHWI, which contributes to the overall goals of the project, and more likely than you as the PI coming to DHWI, you would be sending a graduate student to acquire skills necessary to do this, that type of thing. But travel can also be used to meet with collaborators across the country or even internationally. It's okay to travel to conferences. So if you know that you want to attend next year's MLA or AHA, go ahead and write that in, because you can do that in the context of publicizing and discussing your results, meeting with other collaborators, meeting new potential collaborators.
Right, but notice that Simon said first, you're there basically saying you're going to try and present. You would say, I've submitted an abstract and intend to attend. They're not going to pay for you just to go because you want to go.
No.
They expect you to be on a formal program of some sort.
And you do need to differentiate between domestic and foreign. Yeah.
Actually, what happens with that? So say you've submitted, you haven't heard,
mm-hmm.
but you have your grant going through.
You say that you have submitted for that conference and intend to go to represent the project.
Yeah.
And if it doesn't happen, then you can say, I didn't get it. I still went anyway and participated in these ways. It's just you want to be specific where there's an actual official agenda. Because they will sometimes ask
you. They will sometimes ask you to include the agenda.
And actually your university is usually the one who asks you.
Yeah.
To show an agenda that you were actually there, not just to have a conversation, but to do some work.
Okay, the next direct cost is participant support. And this only actually applies to NSF-funded projects. NEH does not have a category for participant support.
And we'll show you how to get around that.
Yes, we will. It can basically be applied cover the cost of travel and accommodation and feeding of non-project staff at an event. So that means that in theory, Jen could have written a $1 million proposal to the National Science Foundation to host the Digital Humanities Winter Institute.
And there are two proposals in, not to the Science Foundation, but
yeah.
There are two proposals in for the next cycle.
And what she could have done was write in the cost of all of you wonderful people to come and attend, and it would fall under participant support costs.
Which we're trying to do.
On
so
the other hand, the cost of me coming to attend would not count, because I'm actually I would be classified as being a project staff, because I'm one of the presenters, one of the instructors. Likewise, Jen wouldn't. Because she's obviously the principal investigator.
But wouldn't your salary costs be covered?
He would go in as a different category line.
I would go in as a consultant or as an outside vendor. The honorarium that I may or may not receive would go under that line. The cost of me actually flying here and staying here would go under the category of domestic travel. So my costs would be split out across multiple different categories, whereas your costs would all fall under participant support. Now, in reality, you would then actually bullet out the different categories. So you would say that of the $500,000 that we're requesting for participant supports, $200,000 of that is going to go towards travel, $200,000 of that is going to go towards accommodation, and $100,000 of that is going to go towards food and catering expenses associated with it.
And in your justification, you explained how you came to those numbers.
And
you don't just get to randomly pick them out of the air.
Yeah, absolutely explained. So you say that you are assuming it's going to cost $500 to fly to Baltimore. You're assuming that it's going to be $150 a night, and you're assuming that it's going to be $100 per person to feed you. And on top of all of that, that you're anticipating an attendance of 150 people.
Do you you have to differentiate foreign and domestic.
Yep.
And since I would be a foreign.
We're going to go through that when we're going to show you an actual budget that's live and running of something that's been awarded, and I'm going to talk to you about those standards that we use when we configure our budget in terms of foreign versus domestic. There's a formula that he and I both use that we're almost close to the same exactly.
Yeah. So this can include catering, which means it can include food. It can include non-alcoholic drinks. This is always an issue that when you're dealing with participant support costs. That
in the U.S., it has to be non-alcoholic. Canada depends on the competition. With
you can't pay for any hospitality.
Right, and in the U.K., you can pretty much buy whatever you want.
Yeah,
because the U.K.
Yeah, seriously.
They when they take you out of the bar and they open up the premium liquor, it's kind of a nice thing.
You would also cover the cost of renting an auditorium, classrooms, you know, any expenses like that. You can also include the cost of renting equipment. So if this room didn't come with a nice projector, you could rent a projector. The advantage for your budget of classifying things as participant support when you can, which means when you're dealing with the NSF, is you don't have to pay indirects.
One thing I'd actually like to add to that, if you are invited to a SHRC or NSERC or CIHR conference in Canada, they do have funds available for foreign faculty, but not for foreign grad students.
Yep.
So you should definitely inquire about that.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, for foreign grad students, we need the money, but they can cover that.
Okay. Another category is materials and supplies. This is going to be any miscellaneous expenses that you might encounter. It will include things like all of the name tags that you're wearing, cost of printing agendas, things like that. Publication costs is a very specific category where a publisher charges you for the privilege of publishing in their journal, which doesn't happen as much in the humanities as it does in science disciplines, but it's an important thing to bear in mind, and if you are, generally speaking, a collaborator will tell you that they would like to include that cost if possible.
This can also go into things like project reports that are being professionally done where you have specialized figures and you have to hire someone that's going to do that work.
Yep, so that actually goes into the other category, which is basically the everything else that is allowed. So that might include things like server hosting fees. It might include the purchase of laptops or other computer-related equipment that will be used specifically for the project. It's where you would put catering room rental costs if participant supports category is not allowed. So in all of our NEH grants, this is where those fees would go for workshops and things like that. It's where you would put your consultant fees and honoraria, if necessary. It's where you would put all of your publicity swag that we talked about this morning. And anything else that I haven't captured here that is allowable. Yeah.
For server hosting fees, like if I'm buying a domain name, can I include in that buying that domain name for 5 or 10 years? Or does it have to be...
All it is a lump sum.
It's a lump sum. So,
you don't have to say it's for 5 years.
No, but would that be an allowable decision?
Yes,
absolutely. 5 years hosting in 5 years.
You don't even say
5 years. You just say...
No, like, I could use that.
Yes.
Use that as a calculating.
Yeah.
Yes, absolutely. Okay. So, the other major category that you will come across is subcontracts. Subcontracts occur basically when you have more than one institution working together on the project and they both want money. What happens when you do this is that, generally speaking, one of your institutions will be designated as the lead institute. They will be the institution that is responsible for preparing the budget, preparing the proposal, and for submitting the proposal. Now, having said that, of course, the budget, the narrative, et cetera, will have been prepared collaboratively. But NEH only wants to see one copy of your proposal. They don't want to see Maryland submitting a proposal and Clemson submitting exactly the same proposal because they happen to be partner institutions. So So what you do is you prepare two separate budgets. On the lead institute, there is a category for subcontracts, and you would simply say $25,000. Clemson would submit their own budget, which would be explaining how they plan to spend their $25,000 of the budget. And the requirements of the Clemson budget would be exactly the same as what we've just walked through for the main part of it. What then happens is that my person at Clemson, the grants officer, the person who's generally responsible for approving this, will work with Jen's grants person and will make sure that everyone's on the same page. We will send to Maryland a scope of work, which is basically a paragraph or up to a page, roughly. It varies depending on the grant, that outlines what specific work Clemson will be doing as part of the budget, as part of the project, the actual budget, and the budget justification, and then a letter that is signed by our vice president for research, saying that we agree to do all of this. Maryland then hits submit. Yeah.
When you have a partner organization like that, do you do that like updates frequently throughout the cycle of the grant?
What do you mean by updates?
So you said the scope of work, the budget. Well, I guess that would come under
That happens actually when the project gets awarded. You have to open a series of accounts, and so it happens two different times. It happens before the grant goes in. The grant officers all talk to each other at your institutions, and they agree to what the scope of work is. Usually we write that and draft that for them. They all check our math and make sure we're complying with the university rules. They package that and send that with our grant. So they'll take care of signing off on it. You always have to have a signatory on a grant. We're going to talk about that when we get to the review process one. But then the second time you do that is actually when the grant is awarded. They bring back out those documents, and they take a look at them, and they make sure that whatever they're going to actually implement is still compliant with what the university rules are at that point, because often there's a year
and
the rules can change and sort of fade. You don't actually send out to your project partners all of that information usually, regularly. You usually just give them the information as it goes into the granting agency originally, and then you give them at the end the final report. You don't want them paying attention to what you're spending, when and how fast and how rapidly. Because they get a little nervous when money spends fast, and they also get a little nervous when money spends slow.
Yeah. So the key is that, you know, if you're on a project that includes a subcontract, your sponsoring agency will send a lump sum to the lead institution, and the lead institution is then responsible for divvying up the money to all of the subcontracts, and you can have one subcontract, or in the case of a project I'm working on right now, you can have 10 subcontracts. With the NSF, there is an alternative to this model. It's called a collaborative grant. We don't need to talk about it. You just need to be aware that there is an option. Basically, what that means is that what I just said about how NEH doesn't want to see the same grants submitted multiple times by the same institution. That's exactly what happens, just with different budgets attached to it. But they're linked in the system. NSF uses a system called Fastlane. All of the grants are linked in the system. So actually, one institution is responsible for uploading the project narrative, and then each institution separately uploads their budgets and things. You don't need to worry about the logistics of that. Just be aware that there is a very rarely used alternative to this in the context of the National Science Foundation. Okay, so finally we're on to the part about the endurance. Basically, your institution wants their cut of your hard work. Okay, indirects are used by the institution to pay for all of the things that aren't directly related to a project, but that make that project possible. So it pays for example, the lighting and the heating. It pays for paper that goes in your printer. It pays for the grants officer who works with you and hits submit. It pays for all of those different things that you as a researcher or a student take for granted. That's what it all goes for. The rate at which indirects are charged is actually a federally negotiated rate. Each institution will individually negotiate with a government agency what rate of indirects to charge. At Clemson right now, that rate is 49.5%, which is actually ridiculously low compared to Maryland's 58. And we are actually going up to 50 in the next financial year. So we're still low, but it's going up. Actually makes my life easier because 50 is a lot nicer to calculate. So it's typically calculated as 50 to 60% of your direct costs. So all of those costs that we've just talked about go into the calculation of how much you're going to charge on indirect. So, for example, if you're at an institution like Clemson, which charges an indirect rate of 50%, and you are planning to submit a grant to the National Endowment for the Humanities Startup Level 2, which has a maximum budget of $60,000. Can anyone tell me, this is where you need your calculators, how much money you can actually spend off of that grant on direct costs? 40. Okay. So it is the calculation is not 50% of the actual amount. It's 50% of what you actually spend, if that makes sense. So you take it, so it's not, in the case of a 50% indirect rate, it's not half of the budget, it's a third of the budget.
So to give an example, say if you're budgeting a faculty member, if the actual cost of the faculty member is $10,000, what you have to put in the grant is $10,000 for the faculty member plus another $5,000 for indirect costs.
Yep. Yep.
Right.
And after he gets through this slide, yep, we're actually going to do the budget exercise.
Yeah, we'll do the budget exercise.
And we'll show you how you can configure this.
And you'll be pleased to hear this is actually my last slide. So, okay, so with indirects, there are some categories that it's not charged against. So the advantage of the participant support category is that there are no indirects on it, which is fantastic for you if you're doing a workshop-related grant to the NSF. You've got a budget of $100,000. That means that you can actually put together a really nice conference where you've spent $60,000 on all of the facilities, all of the fees. You can get some good speakers coming in, and you still have $40,000 that you can spend on an event manager or on PI salary, something like that. That $40,000, however, is going to have indirects charged against it. So instead of the $40,000, you've really got about $25,000 to spend. Does that make sense?
We're actually going to show you how to do this in an easy way so it doesn't make your head hurt. Yeah.
So I have a question about how there's a range, but it's a federally negotiated rate.
So your university basically has to cut a deal annually with any federal institution. So Department of Homeland Security,
Department of Defense,
Department of Education, they don't really care who it is, but they have to negotiate a rate at some point, and this is done at like that high legal administrative level that you'll never get to be part of.
Yeah.
Right?
Basically,
and they then tell you what the rates are that have been set.
Yeah.
So it's federal negotiation, not federally set.
Yes.
Okay.
Right.
It's negotiated.
Right. It's negotiated.
So that's, I'm looking at our website, the FNA.
Yep,
that's
FNA.
Yes. Indirects are called, it depends where you are, and it depends who you're submitting to.
So FNA is Facilities and Administration, is the acronym FNA.
And indirects is Indirect Cost Recovery.
They're the same damn thing, no matter who you talk to. Okay.
There are occasions where a solicitation will actually prohibit the use of the charging of indirects.
Melon.
Melon is a good one. Haystack grants often don't allow indirects to be charged.
Private funders usually don't like it.
What you have to do is when you send your budget and your narrative and what have you to your grants officer, and actually you probably want to do this even earlier than that, what you have to do is send them a printout or an email link to the page that says indirects are not allowed on this grant. Because otherwise they will come back to you and they'll say, well, why haven't you considered indirects? So they want to, they need to show that. Yeah.
We work a lot with Mellon, and yep. One of the things that we've done, and it's part of the reason why sometimes large states like to work with us and small privates, is that then what we do is we say we're the recipient of the grant. We're getting it from Mellon. We can't offer you that 50% overhead. And actually, some of the people we work with at the large states like it.
Right.
Because that way they can get the
right.
money.
Yeah.
You can itemize those things for Mellon or places that charge zero indirect. Things like having your business manager process all the financial paperwork. That is an allowable expense. Even though it's usually covered under indirect and FNA, they still will let you do that. And every funder has a list of what they will allow you to charge on their competitions.
So that's where partnership can work
yep.
out, depending on who,
right.
who you make.
So Simon and I, and I'm going to use this as an example in a few minutes, Simon and I negotiated a grant that I actually was the one who submitted because my FNA rate was lower than where he was at. So it was to our benefit that the majority of the money came to my institution
mm-hmm.
before it got routed to him because we were able to keep on and hold on more dollars. If it would have gone to him first, they would have taken out 60-some percent, and then my money would have come to me. Whereas my institution I negotiated for, I think it was like 38% or something. Yeah.
So the indirects, if you're a sub...
contract?
Yes, thank you. Then your institution can't take indirects on your grant.
Okay, here's the line. Indirects are typically charged on first $25,000 of a subcontract. Actually, if we are working on a proposal, Jen has to include all indirects on her that Marilyn would charge. She would then send the budget to me at Clemson because I have a much nicer indirect rate. Clemson will actually take an indirect cut on the first $25,000 of that subcontract out of my budget.
So if we have $1 million, and we're just going to call it a 50% rate, even though that's not what Maryland uses. Say Maryland takes 50%. That now means we have $500,000 to work with.
Wouldn't you have
660?
Well, sorry, 600, whatever it is. I always do that.
That's why I went with the 60,000.
Thank
math
you,
is a lot easier.
666. And let's say his subcontract is for $100,000 of that. They basically do indirects at his rate on the $100,000 minus, so only on $75,000 is their indirect charge, depending on the university.
But who charges it? Your university?
They do. They do.
No, it's
no.
Both.
They flip it. Sorry.
Wouldn't it be the other way around? That the indirects
are
only
right.
on the first 25, and so the next
75. Well, it
would
depends
be
on your
indirects.
School. Some
right.
people will excuse the first $25,000, and then they start charging indirects.
Okay.
And other schools charge on the first 25 and not on the rest.
Yeah. So at Clemson, the theory is that it takes staff time
mm-hmm.
to manage that subcontract.
Okay.
So they want to get reimbursed for that staff salary first. And the amount of work that's involved with a $25,000 subcontract is essentially the same as a $100,000 subcontract. And most subcontracts are going to be under $25,000. So that's how that comes out. But yeah, with all of this, you have to check with your own institution-specific requirements.
And here's the thing. You yourself, as a project manager or PI, do not have to figure this out yourself. Your institution has someone
who will
that
tell you.
Must figure this out for you
right.
and your particular institutional circumstances. The reason why we're actually training you in this is because if you do one digital humanities project, you likely do more than one, and it's a lot quicker for you to learn these rules and to write the budget correctly the first time and send it to them as a draft that they then check for compliance and send back to you with okay. So Kelsey experienced this internally, where she came in and met with me because they were getting ready to submit a grant. She said to me, these are the things I need. I said, here's the numbers you need. Fill them in. They went. And then now they've asked for a revision because they won the grant. They want to ask for some more details. But because I'm somebody that does this all the time, it only takes me a second to think about it, and I can generally spit it out on a piece of paper. As an independent faculty member or somebody with an independent project, almost always your department representative who does your books for your department will sit down with you the first time you go to submit a project, and will talk to you about the rules and regulations that your department has about how this process works, and we'll talk about that in a second. But somebody will walk you through this, because the university will figure out how to get the money it wants off of it.
Yeah, they will.
So they'll fix any errors you make.
So can I just,
yes,
real quickly, one last clarification. You're the lead.
Yes.
You're the subcontractor.
Yep.
Your university takes $25,000 in directs.
No. it's going to depend a little bit on what the policies are at the university. So I think part of the confusion is that actually Clemson's policy is that they, if we are a subcontract, we still have to include as part of that subcontract our indirect costs.
So
Jen's institution would, on top of that,
charge
their indirects, and it would come out to...
So the same pot of money went from having 20% charged against it to, because it has two parties involved, having 70% charged against it.
Gotcha.
Does that help smooth that thought process out?
Yes.
So what it means is you want to be careful about subcontracts,
mm-hmm,
particularly on small grants. Mm-hmm. Anything less than $250,000, it is likely a waste of your time to have external partners, because the money disappears before it's even hit the door.
Or you want to do it as a consultant's cost, you know, something else.
Pay them something outside of the university system.
Yeah. So if there is one collaborator who absolutely has to be on your project for it to be successful, but they happen to be at University of Southern California,
mm-hmm,
instead of doing it as a subcontract where their salary is paid out of that, do it as an honorarium or as a consultant service. And that will make life a lot easier. It makes life a lot easier for everyone except for your consultant, who then has to worry about the tax implications.
So, in terms of the order of behavior, you negotiate your subcontract first, because whatever number he's got going is going to be the one that has to show up in my budget that tells me how much money is left. So when we start a budget process, he does his draft first and sends it to me for comment and approval. And once we've negotiated and agreed on how much money his stuff is going to be in his work plan, that's then when the rest of the money comes to me and I figure it out. And the reason why you do it that way is, why would you have a subcontractor that you didn't really need? You know, you're ensuring that the work he's providing is that important that you're willing to potentially let him take a cut of money that is very substantial. Yeah, Rachel.
If you were to consult, does that sort of bypass, so Simon, if you were to consult for Jen, your university doesn't get involved at all? You do that sort of outside of your 40 hours a week?
Your university has reporting requirements about how that works.
So I would have to, what I would have to do is fill out a conflict of interests form, which is basically saying that I'm not going to be, I'm not going out and I'm consulting on a competing product or a competing project,
right,
or that I'm not going out and I'm being paid by someone who is providing services to the other services to the university that I might be involved in.
And as digital humanists, where this sort of comes into play is, you may have a very highly specialized set of skills that other institutions cannot get access to, that your university is not taking advantage of in your daily 40-hour week thing. The protocol is that whoever is your direct boss, you ask them before you commit to that outside position. Don't do it behind their back. It's a small community. Somebody's going to find out and tell them. But the other way that this becomes a protocol or something that's very important is, when you think about consulting work, you have to remember the fact that oftentimes people are writing for the same grants and the same competitions. And it has happened to both of us in situations before where we have independently started working with other projects or other teams to help them with things because we anticipate being a consultant on the grant, and our institution has decided to join that competition. At that point, we have to walk away from our consultancy job because that is a conflict. Our university takes priority. They have the rights to us first. It's just good politic. Generally speaking, bosses are pretty good about it in the digital humanities because they're usually faculty who don't know any better. No offense to faculty, but they generally don't know any better. But this is particularly important in terms of if you're somebody who's an administrator,
knowing what rules exist about conflict of interest is a big thing.
Yeah.
You mentioned earlier that NSF allows collaboration instead of subcontracting.
Collaborative grants, yeah.
Does that mean that you only have one layer of indirect cost?
That means what that will mean is that each institution will directly receive their money from NSF, and if Clemson is the lead institute on the collaboration, and Maryland is a partner in that, Maryland would charge their 58% indirect rate on their grant. I would charge my 50% indirect rate. They are completely separate as far as
our own money.
Yeah. So that is an advantage of doing it.
The other thing we want to highlight with this, and this is actually the last line on the slide before we go to the budget exercise, is you can actually request a waiver of your indirect rate. So at Maryland, because we're a large research institution and a teaching institution, there are different rates for the types of activity we have. So core research activities that occur on the University of Maryland campus or within a 100-mile radius, we charge 58%. Core research activities where they occur more than 100 miles from the campus for a duration of longer than 3 weeks, we charge, I think it's 42%. Core teaching activities that occur are 48%. Core teaching activities that occur more than 3 weeks away, or 3 months away, I guess, for teaching, more than 3 months away is actually only 32%. So your university will provide guidance on which rate you should be using. But here's the thing. Most grant people in your university are always going to tell you that you have to use the research rate, even if you are writing a teaching grant. And this is where you argue to the death with them that what you're actually doing is training and teaching, not research in the way they think of it for sciences. Okay?
So if you get a grant for DHWI next year, you will be fighting tooth and nail to say this is a teaching
grant. This is a teaching grant. This is not a research grant.
So it's only 48%, not 58%.
Yeah. And the reason why is that when they configure indirects for research rates, they configure it to include lab spaces like massive genomics, bioinformatics, geology labs. When you're teaching in the humanities, you see the labs we have. You know, we've got 30 Macs in a room, and that's as extravagant as it gets.
And the final point of that is that if you have a grant and you absolutely cannot work out a way to keep it under the limit whilst also including the indirect rate, whatever that is, you can go to the vice president or vice chancellor of research and you can request a waiver on it. That happens extremely rarely that they are willing to do that for you. But both Jen and I have been on proposals where our boss, and it won't actually be you that does it. It will be your boss that will go out and negotiate that, or even your dean. So
we're running Shared Horizons in April. That was a $25,000 Chairman's Award from the NEH. There is no value on the university for that other than PR, and they've waived some of the rates on that because there's tremendous value to them publicly and in terms of the research they want to facilitate. It's 25 grand, which means if they took their indirect rate off of the top of that, even at 32%, or 40%, I'd have 10 grand to do a 50-person event. And you can't do a 50-person event on 10 grand when you're bringing in 50 people from all over the United States.
Would it be fair to assume that that kind of waiver is more likely to come from a smaller kind of resource?
Well, low-resource providers can negotiate this because they know the people.
Well, and also because the prestige for the university goes
way
up.
It's also much more likely to be granted if it's if the budget level is lower, because administrators are going to see the dollar signs in $1 million proposal.
I will also mention too that at low resource institutions, you may have one grant officer for the entire campus who may look askance at the fact that you're actually writing a grant and may not know what to do with it. This happens. I just went through this with my colleague at Illinois College, where it took us 8 phone calls to find out who the right person was that I needed to talk to find out the rates. Because he couldn't find it, I couldn't find it, and there was some craziness going on. The reality is that small schools, because they know each other, it's a lot easier to talk someone into it because they only need one signature. Here, when you get something through for the grant process, and we'll talk about this, I have to have 4 signatures on it. There's one person, and then the president of the university reviewed it. Here, you can't find the president of the university. If you, I mean, he's a nice guy, he's around a lot, but he doesn't sign off on my paperwork.